Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, if the current trend continues, the Romney campaign will not need to spend a dollar on this campaign. All they can do is just wait for Obama supporters and officials and campaign advisors to go on TV and make their case for them. Hillary Rosen, of course, last week talking about Ann Romney allegedly not working a day in her life, a huge backlash to that. Now we have David Axelrod going on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, and here is his attempt to frame economically what this campaign is about between President Obama and Mitt Romney.
The choice in this election is between an economy that produces a growing middle class and that gives people a chance to get ahead and their kids a chance to get ahead, and an economy that continues down the road we're on.
Yes, that's exactly what this election is potentially about, Jim. So thanks to David Axelrod for making that case for us. The larger context is, I think, that he's trying to make is that he's still trying to paint President Obama as the outsider, and this current road that we're on is either still Bush's fault or something. But apparently he sees Romney as the insider and him as the outsider, which is going to look pretty stupid 4 years after taking office.
Precisely, Greg. This might be a Freudian slip on Axelrod's part. But I think that, you know, on some level, with the president having such a lousy record to run on, you know, 4 years of high unemployment, the housing market is still moribund. Gas prices are averaging $3.89 per gallon and much higher than $4 a gallon in much of the country. I was just checking earlier today, the rate of inflation for food prices is quite is increasing for butter and various other basic foodstuffs. So this is not a record to run on. And so you wonder if this is Axelrod wishing that he was the challenger and that he was able to run against this record, or this perception that, you know, look, America, as soon as Obama gets in there, gets into office, it's going to get better. And you can't run that message. You can't be the embodiment of hope and change when you've been in power for 4 years. Somebody had once said that every presidential campaign boils down to two basic messages, or three basic, you know, a return to normalcy, don't change horses in the middle of the stream, or the third variation is it's time for a change. Well, Obama has to run on don't change horses in the middle of the stream. The problem is that this, you know, this horse got us into the stream. You know, the stream, the water is getting higher. And there's another horse that looks a heck of a lot better right now. So good to see Axelrod getting tongue-tied and ending up blurting out things he may not have necessarily intended. But look for the broader theme of Obama trying to pretend he hasn't been in office since January 2009. I'd like to think the electorate will be smart enough to see through that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chris Wallace was back. He was off last week due to the death of his father, Mike Wallace. But back in rare form, as always, going after David Axelrod on the Buffett rule, which, as we established last week, would provide $47 billion over 10 years. And Chris Wallace able to put it in a slightly different perspective for us. And here's, following that, Axelrod's attempt to defend the policy.
David, according to one estimate, the money you would get from the Buffett rule would cover just 17 days of the increased deficit under the Obama budget.
I remember when $47 billion seemed like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. There is a question when you reduce the when you eliminate the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy, that adds another $800 billion.
You know when $47 billion seemed like a lot more money, Jim? Back in 2009. if you add a completely separate program that adds a whole lot more tax increases, you'll raise taxes even more. So that completely unrelated proposal didn't actually help him too much, I don't think.
Look, if we raise taxes by $800 billion, then this $47 billion, it makes this $47 billion look like a lot more. Yeah, because you raise taxes by $800 billion, you know. It's kind of like, you know, Greg, you might argue that the number one is a small number. But once we add, you know, a bazillion, then it looks like a much bigger number together. Well, yes, the big part comes from the bazillion part, not from the one part. Look, this gives Obama a chance to, you know, look, we all know that this is demagoguery. This is not serious tax policy. This is an attempt to say, America, you're going through hard times, and the problem is that guy over there, the rich guy over there. It's all his fault. If he paid more in taxes, then everything would be hunky-dory. And, you know, Americans are naturally skeptical after 4 years of hard times. Americans are you know, frustrated, and there'll be this inclination towards scapegoating. But so far, this is not really moving the numbers amongst independents. And I don't really think that having Axelrod on the Sunday shows is really going to move the numbers all that dramatically.
Martini number two now. And speaking of people that are really rich, let's talk about Too Big to Fail. Ed Morrissey over at HotAir.com reporting this off of Bloomberg, suggesting that the president's efforts to rein in Too Big to Fail, shock of all shocks, has failed, pointing out, according to Bloomberg, that the five banks that held assets equal to 43% of the U.S. economy in 2007 before the financial crisis now control assets that equal 56% of the U.S. economy. So not only did Dodd-Frank not do what it was supposed to do, it's just made life miserable for people who are playing by the rules.
For those of us on the right, this is a particularly thorny and unique problem because, generally speaking, we want to see minimal government regulation. We don't believe the government's heavy hand is very good at sorting out these sorts of problems. We want to let the free market run freely. But there is a danger of having too much financial power concentrated in too few hands. And in the case of the whole argument of too big to fail was that ordinarily, if Lehman Brothers, if these other larger banks, you know, were horribly managed, they made terrible decisions, they made financial bets that they could not pay off, they ordinarily would say, okay, let them fail. Except the problem was that they were so large and had so many ties into the various other, you know, portions of the economy that they would end up having a domino effect. It would end up having, you know, severe financial repercussions throughout the rest of the country. Oh, by the way, apparently even more severe than the financial repercussions that we suffered and that we are still suffering today. What do you do in these circumstances? Well, now we know one answer. Don't do Dodd-Frank. That was not what worked. If you're going to try to break up these organizations that basically, after promising that Dodd-Frank was going to put the end of the era of too big to fail and endless bailouts, one, Dodd-Frank puts the government pretty much on the hook for additional bailouts for into perpetuity. And secondly, this is just kind of the whole argument. This puts the notion of Obama as the spirit of the 99% or standing up for the little guy pretty scoffing. This is an administration that is much more interested in making sure that, you know, Buffett pays more in taxes, which he obviously can voluntarily pay, than for to actually worry about large institutions like AIG and other large banks that end up having so many financial ties to so many other large institutions that the failure of any one of them would have, you know, calamitous results for our economy. This is one of those cases in which businesses can get too big to fail. The answer then is to begin to break them up into smaller places. You think that Democrats, who are traditionally always going on and on about the fear of monopolies, will be more aware of this. But I think we are a sense of a drift in our financial policies, as we are in a drift in many other areas of policy, it seems, Greg.
Yeah, the thing I like here that also Ed reports from the Bloomberg article is this. Market participants believe that nothing has changed, that too big to fail is fully intact, and that specter is eroding faith in Obama's pledge that taxpayer-funded bailouts are a thing of the past, and is exposing him to criticism from federal officials, Republicans, and Occupy Wall Street supporters who see this as a concentration of bank power and a threat to economic stability. So even the crazies on Wall Street are becoming more and more disillusioned with Obama. I'm not so rosy as to think they'll actually vote for Romney, but the fact that a bunch of them might not actually bother to vote for Obama makes me pretty happy.
It does. It's worth noting. This will be a big, serious challenge for the next Republican president, presuming that it is Mitt Romney. Look, you know, this is not going to be the sort of thing which is going to be very easy to characterize these sort of things as you know, heavy-handed government intervention. But at the same time, the idea of our banking industry getting way too intertwined with each other and the idea of putting, you know, any one of them being at a risk for failure, taking all the rest of them with them. This is you know, a serious problem, and it reserves a serious answer. And, you know, Obama's just too addicted to the demagoguery to offer a serious answer.
Absolutely right. Well, the president, of course, spent most of the weekend at the Summit of the Americas in Cartagena, Colombia. And, of course, everyone knows what was on the agenda. Oh, no, nobody knows what was on the agenda, thanks to the scandal surrounding the U.S. Secret Service. 11 folks sent home, at least 5 military officials. Also apparently wrapped up in this prostitution scandal that blew up very late Friday into Saturday. And apparently it was over one Secret Service agent not willing to pay a prostitute $47. Jim, there are so many wrong issues here as you relate in the morning jolt. Obviously, these guys, if they have families, and even if they don't, are showing a horrific moral conviction here. And secondly, the ability, as Daryl Issa has said, for these guys to be blackmailed as a result of their ridiculously unprofessional behavior leaves America and America's leaders, including the president, potentially vulnerable. It's clear these guys have not watched a lot of James Bond movies.
Well, never mind James Bond movie. I mean, the fascinating thing is that if this were a thriller novel in which a large chunk of the U.S. Secret Service on the presidential detail was out carousing with prostitutes, the editor would reject it and say, oh, come on, this is just not plausible. Maybe you could have one bad apple and this guy could get blackmailed and that's how the bad guys could get the jump on the president or something. But you would never have, 10, 11 agents all doing this sort of thing. And so what's kind of baffling is, in the jolt, I'd observe it, look, I want to have a certain amount of modesty in my criticism of Secret Service agents, because let's face it, this has got to be the toughest job, among the very toughest job in the world. As I said, no matter how complicated your relationship is with your boss, and Greg, I don't know about how you're doing, Rich Lowry and I have a pretty good relationship, but at least if somebody tries to shoot Rich Lowry, I have the option of jumping in front of that bullet or not. It's one of those things where only a U.S. Secret Service agent, are you expected to die if that circumstance comes to the fore, and it would be kind of seen as a major shame on your part to not jump in the way. You have to be willing to not just risk your life, but really, perhaps a more explicit form, sacrifice your life if necessary. God forbid that ever becomes necessary. And Secret Service agents during the attempted assassination on Reagan and such, they live with this all day long and all throughout their careers. This has got to be an extraordinary amount of pressure. And so I understand that, boys will be boys, men will be men. There'll be a desire to relieve some of that stress. But guys, did you all think that these women were just hanging around? I can't quite understand how the circumstances could occur that all of these men could end up in these circumstances and not recognize, never mind the morality of it, never mind the legality of it, never mind the professional, the enormous security risk that this represented. And you have to figure that for these guys, that's got to be job one. Except that it wasn't. So we're baffled by this. It's unnerving. It's disturbing. And this would have made a great season of 24, wouldn't it, Greg?
Yeah, exactly right.
This would have been a plot twist a little too implausible for 24. And then at least once per season, the vice president was launching a coup.
So. That's right. Oh, man. And Jay Carney said the president won't comment during an active investigation, which we have to applaud because I think that's the first time he's decided not to comment during an active investigation. We'll see if he holds to that, but that should be the right policy for now. Jim, crazy weekend. We'll talk to you later.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg. See ya.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today in the 3 Martini Lunch, and please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.